would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the unceded lands this podcast is recorded on, and pay our respects to elders past and present. Hi, and welcome to Glamour Disability in Dialogue, the podcast that delves into the intersection of disability and neurodiversity in galleries, libraries, archives, museums, and records professions. We're all about inclusivity, challenging the norm, and creating positive change, impact, and community. In this episode, I talk with Dr. Matt Harrison, Dr. Jessica Reardon, and Dr. Sarah Timperley about their work with the Neurodiversity Project, an initiative supporting the University of Melbourne's neurodivergent community. We chat about the need for this project, its impact on community, lived experience leadership, and sustaining cultural change in higher education. So today I am joined by Dr. Matt Harrison, Dr. Jessica Reardon, and Dr. Sarah Timperley from the University of Melbourne's Neurodiversity Project, which aims to better support the University of Melbourne's neurodivergent community. So thank you so much for joining me, Jess, Sarah, and Matt.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So before we do actually jump into more conversation and chatting about this, it would be really great if you could each introduce yourselves for our listeners and perhaps just describe a little bit more broadly about what the Neurodiversity Project is, what you do in that space, and perhaps your roles in it as well.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Jess. I have a background in developmental psychology, and that's what my PhD is in. But right now I sit here in the Faculty of Education, and together us three have developed this project based on other successful projects to really empower our community and to help our university to kind of become a more global leader in neurodiversity inclusive research and practice. And we have four main aims there. One is to build a stronger sense of community, which is sorely needed for our neurodivergent staff and students. We also help to improve understanding, or hope we should help to improve understanding of neurodiversity and neuroaffirming teaching and learning practices across the university. We're also trying to connect staff and students with support services and conduct neurodiversity affirming research. Cool. And I'll pass on to Matt.
Yeah. Hello, I'm Dr. Matthew Harrison, formerly Matt to most people. My research has always been around the idea of how we can reduce barriers for people in terms of social inclusion. And so I am a teacher by background, so I focus on typically 8 to 15 year olds, but I've been really excited to be able to work with Jess and Sarah and to focus on really inclusive teaching at a university level. So my role is I'm the Jem Scott Teaching Fellow, which is it's a program at the University of Melbourne that helps us to think about ways of improving teaching and learning experiences. And we saw there's a real need in to help upskill our staff to better support our neurodivergent students in this, so they have better learning experiences. So that's really more my focus.
Cool. And I'm Sarah, or formerly Dr. Sarah Timperley, if we're doing that.
I did it.
I've had a bit of a random assortment of professional things going on, as I think a lot of neurodivergent people do. I started in doing a PhD in developmental psychology in the same lab as Jess. That's how we knew each other. I then did some work around development of like executive function and self-regulation a little bit. And a lot of that was giving professional development to educators, especially kindergarten educators and stuff. But one of the things that I really enjoyed about that is a lot of the educators took that learning for themselves rather than just for the kids. It was like, oh no, everyone needs this, needs to talk about, you know, how it's difficult to task switch and like these sorts of things. Then I did some work in program evaluation, which again, really fascinating, sort of evaluating how programs work, and especially big programs that are very complicated, and most of the time it was looking at how they don't work. And then I was very lucky to sort of meet Matt more this neurodiversity space, which I'd wanted to do for ages because I have ADHD, but you know, you kind of end up in a random assortment of roles in higher education.
No, I was going to say, it sounds like the combination of backgrounds that you've had, like you've been able to actually bring them to this project with you, and it's really helped to define the direction it's taken.
Yeah, I think so. Mm. I think
I wouldn't want to do this project without Sarah and Jess. I think the thing that's really nice about this is the three of us do complement each other. We talk Definitely. About a strength-based approach. I've learned so much working with Sarah and Jess, and I think one of the really nice things to have other people with the experience that you work with is that you get each other, but also you begin to learn, predict where there will be areas of challenge. And that really, that's just so refreshing to sort of find people who get you. That is really nice.
But it sounds like a lot of the, there's been a lot of conversations that we're already having, that were already being had in higher education that you've kind of built off. Was there anything specific at the University of Melbourne that kind of prompted the neurodiversity project to come about?
I can start with the very beginning of the story. It'll be chronological for your listeners here. I am part of a social enterprise. We set up a social enterprise based around cooperative gaming groups for neurodivergent children. And this was my area of my PhD research. And I worked with another researcher, Jessica Rowlings, who became the CEO of Next Level Collaboration, which is the social enterprise we set up. And she's the first openly female autistic CEO to come from the University of Melbourne. And the vice chancellor came to our launch event for our social enterprise. And we obviously made an impact because months later, he reached out asking what to do to better support our neurodivergent community. And I'd been doing some research with Jess and Sarah around the experiences of the faculty of neurodivergent staff and students at the Faculty of Education. And Jess, do you want to talk about that research? Because you've just submitted the paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We resubmitted that today. We interviewed some staff and postgraduate students here within a faculty at the University of Melbourne. And about their experiences overall. It started off being about their sensory experiences and how they navigate the sensory space. So it was open to anyone with sensory differences. But it also grew from that. And this thread kind of kept coming through all of it, that there was a lot of support needed and it moved well beyond the sensory. And that a lot of people really wanted help and wanted the community, but they all thought they were alone in this. And it really sparked us to think, you know, it'd be great if there was like a centralized kind of group that was one day going to help tie everything together, find other people working in this space, try and change things, because we frankly heard some really horrific stories of just how people have been forced to navigate higher education alone. So yeah, that sense of justice got triggered. And then rather than putting it off, I think we said this in one of my talks, Matt's like, why not now? Why not we just try and do something as a group?
Yeah. So we had the vice chancellor reach out asking to resolve a particular situation, which just doesn't happen. Like when I got the email, I thought it was spam. And so I was like, I'm not giving you my password and username. This is not really the vice chancellor. And then the vice chancellor's chief of staff emailed back saying, are you going to respond to the vice chancellor? I'm like, whoops, probably better respond to that email. And the three of us thought it's time to pitch something that's comprehensive and that looks at cultural change. You know, that is it. It's not just individual cases. It's a cultural shift that is needed. And so we looked at what Lawrence Fung had set up at Stanford University. I'm not sure if your listeners are familiar with Stanford's Neurodiversity Project. But the three of us looked at that as a potential model rather than reinventing the wheel. And we put together a proposal, a pitch, including a video, which is, I don't think the vice chancellor gets many video pitches. but I think the vice chancellor obviously enjoyed our video pitch because he helped to ensure that we were fully funded. Some support from the Faculty of Education, and to make sure that we had the political buy-in across our university, which has been a game changer. When you have your vice chancellor on side, people start listening more, we think. Anyway.
Especially when it's that cultural change element and that bigger picture that you're talking about as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just thought it was worth mentioning. It was really personal as well in terms of that sense of justice from the sensory spaces research, because it was a lot of stories, especially for me, that were so familiar to me of my own experiences and stuff that I had always blamed myself for, and then gone, oh no, this is a really shared experience. This is not, there's something wrong with you. There is something wrong with the way that the system responds to people who are neurodivergent. So yeah, I think it's worth like being like, yeah, no, we're in this for personal as well as, you know, I think it's important to make sure people know that you're part of the community that you're trying to create. So yeah, I just thought I'd add that.
Yeah, I think we're not going to solve every problem through what we're looking to set up, not by any means, but I think it's that visibility and saying that there's others out there. And I think I think Jess and Sarah both spoke about the loneliness people felt, and that's been, for me, the one thing that stood out is people start to see a community and they start to believe, have hope that the system can change, which is, you know, I think hope is so important in life for anyone.
Yeah, and that would have really come down to that lived experience leadership of this project as well. Like, you've each touched on the role that that's played. Have you seen that significance, especially in building community?
Definitely. I think we have recently run a staff needs analysis led by Sarah, and you know, we've had lots of feedback from people from there and other initiatives that they wouldn't have engaged if it wasn't neurodivergent led. Because not only do they know we don't necessarily have an agenda or that it's not performative, but that we do get the experience, and that people said, oh, this was clearly written by someone with ADHD and I love it.
Coming from someone not from the community, this is clearly written by someone with ADHD would have been an insult, but I'm pretty sure it was a compliment in this one.
Yeah. and I think it really has a lot of safety built into it for our community who have felt alone, who have not wanted to disclose, that I think it's really important that it is led from neurodivergent people. But also the other thing is that it keeps us passionate about it because we have lived it and we have that shared experience to kind of push it through.
I think the other thing that's really that safety element is when we first did this looking at lived experiences at the faculty level around sensory spaces, I had people come and disclose to me who I'd worked with for 7 years. And you know, work in learning intervention in the autism space. And there's people I've worked with and I had no idea that they're autistic, for example. And they came and saw me and said, this is the first time I think I've ever disclosed at the university. These were professors or associate professors in their, these were people who've been at the institution for 20, 30 years. So it was just a shock that these people were only now feeling like they could come forward. But they really, really wanted to be able to share their experiences. And that was just so powerful in itself that they've just been clinging on and surviving to hope. If you're a professor, an associate professor, you've survived to a certain extent, but it's learning about the deep cost to their well-being, and that masking or that survival mechanism how it's really how it's impacted on them personally. I think that was a huge, both made me sad that people had to do that, but also is a huge privilege that we had to people to feel safe to do that. Talk to us. Yeah, that's something I'm always grateful for.
Yeah, and it sounds like that visibility just made a massive difference from the outset then to, I guess, that the cultural acceptance around it and people's willingness to step forward and be part of it.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where it's like you wouldn't want someone not part of the community to run any other community. So why is it okay when it comes to neurodiversity for everybody else to speak for neurodivergent people? It makes no sense. Like, yeah.
I think historically in this country we have... We have, and I'm sure other countries, if your listeners are around the world, you know, we have spoken for First Nations Australians or other people from First Nations cultures, or we've spoken for, you know, members of the queer community, or we've spoken, yeah, it is something that, you know, so the value of lived experience is a shared thing. I know everyone's cases, there's nuances and differences, of course, but there is a general theme about listening to people with direct lived experience.
And that is a challenge for all those other groups. Sorry, I don't mean to be like, no, we do it well in other groups. Like, no, we don't, but we should.
Yeah. And you mentioned a needs analysis that you've done as well. Was that something that you did from the outset? What did that involve?
Yeah, so that actually only closed, well, I guess it's nearly a month ago now. But yeah, so that was something that was planned from the outset to make sure that our community voice is actually heard. But, you know, like, we're three people. But a lot of the things we heard from the community were probably what things that we would, you know, were hoping to do. So that was really affirming. Obviously, there's a lot of other things in there that we hadn't considered that we'll have to consider. One of the things that I made sure I put was lots of open text boxes, because as neurodivergent people, we always have more to say about things than the options given. So there's lots of things for me to analyze there. But like a few big takeaways we've gotten so far is, firstly, we had a huge response. I think it was like 200, and now I should have brought up the exact numbers, but I think it was about 262 neurodivergent staff, and then another 160-ish neurotypical staff. 65 of them also suspected they might be neurodivergent. So,
neurocurious.
Yeah, neurocurious. There we go. And I asked about a pretty broad range of conditions, like different, or not necessarily conditions, but like different types of neurodivergence. And what we found is that there's just, it was mostly people with ADHD and autistic people who filled in the survey. And I say mostly, not that there weren't huge amounts of other people, but like those groups were both over 100. I think ADHD was about 160. But there was a huge range of other things. And I think that the main reason it was mostly those two is because those two groups may be the most likely ones to tick on a survey saying neurodiversity. But when I was going through encoding like all the different combinations of different types of neurodivergence that people had, there were 50 different combinations just from one matrix. And so it kind of shows, firstly, like the complexity of the community, but also how I think a lot of research that's often done on these communities might sort of oversimplify things a little bit, which makes it really hard for me to analyze, but really, really good in terms of, getting a sense of what that community looks like. We also found that like 43% of people who said they were neurodivergent in some way or another were also part of the LGBTQIA+ community, which is huge. And also most of our participants were women. I think that's just because women are better at filling out surveys. And like we had a lot of very highly educated people because it's a university sample. So it was one of those things of like, obviously we want to caveat that it is a lot harder for neurodivergent people, and the people in those really higher levels of education are likely to have a lot of trauma, and you know, it's not everyone can make it. But I think there's an assumption out there that, you know, that neurodivergent people aren't, you know, academically capable. And it's like, well, we had 70 neurodivergent participants with PhDs in our sample.
Yeah.
So it is, yeah, some of those stereotypes are really, really outdated.
It is. I think that's it. We had no idea. The university had no idea, and they were very open about this, about how many neurodivergent people we actually had in our institution. And that's, I think that's one of the starting with that staff needs, is to understand who is your community. Is really important. The other thing that I found fascinating, I don't know if you know Sarah and Jess want to speak to this, but 50% or about 50% of our respondents of who are neurodivergent, that's 262 people, 50% were not out in terms to the direct line manager even. So there is a lot of people in the university who don't feel like they want to or feel safe to disclose their neurological differences, and that means that they probably or may not be getting the supports they need, and that is a cultural problem. That is huge, and I think the university, what I give credit to the VC and the university, if they said, okay, let's face this head on, let's talk about this, and I think that's happening at universities around the world now. We're starting to have these conversations. We're not just pretending that neurodivergent people don't exist.
And it's worth noting that having told their direct manager or equivalent doesn't mean they've come out to anybody else. And a lot of those people came out because they felt they had to or did it by accident rather than actually wanting to come out to their manager.
And this was also a research project. It wasn't a compulsory university-wide survey. So this is also the sample of people who were wanting to talk about this and felt safe enough to answer a survey about this. So, I mean, the scope is probably, when we know, will be far larger than this. And I think, I mean, going back to what we were talking about before, about why it's important to be neurodivergent-led, and this is something I mentioned in the talks we give as well, is that, I mean, I have children, I've got two daughters, and if, you know, we're not the generation who's out, who's trying to fix things, to lead by example that there can be a different way. What hope is there for the next generation coming through? So it's really important for those who have the capacity, for those who are willing, not everyone, because it's not everyone's responsibility and no one has to be out, but for those who feel safe to be out, to do so, to try and be those change makers, just for the visibility for the upcoming generation. The conference we just talked at in Michigan, afterwards, I had a few PhD students come up to me crying. And they all said, they've never, ever, ever seen a whole panel of people all openly identify as neurodivergent, talking so open about it, so vulnerably, but also to give them hope. So, yeah, I don't know. I hope that's what we're doing.
The visibility part is just so huge. And that's part of what we want to do as a project, is to spotlight the success stories. There are some brilliant, trailblazing, openly autistic or openly ADHD or professors with, you know, dyslexia doing amazing work. And we want to be able to provide them with a platform, because it's not really about the three of us. We're sort of the conduit for some of this work. But we're temporary in the sense that we're not going to, you know, we may not be here in 5 or 10 years, but we hope the change is sustained. And, you know, the idea that you can see professors who are openly autistic and thriving and proud of their, you know, the fact that they're autistic is so important, because you're going to have these 18-year-olds coming in or 17-year-olds coming into university, not sure, you know, as you are when you're 18, about what the world's going to, you know, hold for you, and you survive the trauma of the VCE or you know, your equivalent around states, and you've got your ATAR, and you're trying to say, what does my future look like? And if you can see someone who's a pediatrician who's also dyslexic, or you can see someone who's got someone who has OCD and that they're a leader in environmental science, or you can see someone who's autistic and is, you know, a specialist in veterinary science, that is just amazing, I think, in the sense that people have that inspiration and that sense of self-efficacy and belief that they can actually do it themselves.
Did having that visibility and this the surveys that you've done kind of, I guess, highlight some of those enablers for, you know, how people have gotten to where they are, or, you know, barriers they've experienced as well?
I haven't looked super into that part of the data yet. I did a lot around the disclosure, so we could present it at Michigan and to our advisory group. In terms of enablers and barriers, like when it comes to the sort of disclosure piece, it's very much, is the person you're disclosing to a safe person to disclose to, and are they going to ask what you need and help you implement those things, or are they going to make your life absolutely unbearable if you stay in that job? And that's, people go both ways. You know, there's people who've reported having really good disclosure experiences and having their managers then enable them to work really well by just, you know, putting in place some of those small things that shouldn't be too hard to do, but somehow, you know, managers can fight against, you know, like saying, hey, can you make sure that you send me things in email instead of verbally telling me? Or, you know, I really need a space of my own, or I will be distracted, or I need some work from home time because this environment is really challenging for me. And some managers are amazing and will just help you with that. And people generally report having really good experiences and being able to sort of work to their full potential with that. And then other people will disclose and then immediately have doors shut in front of them, you know. And yeah, people have both experiences, and like the same person has both experiences a lot of the time. So those are the enablers and barriers I kind of feel comfortable talking about now. I'm sure I'll have more to share once I've finished analyzing the rest of the survey, but definitely having people who are understanding, and they don't even need to be knowledgeable if they're just willing to like listen, but that can be hard, you know. Yeah,
it's really interesting. I can say that for people who I've chosen to disclose to, I've had wonderful reception. And Sarah mentioned some just trends in the data that she was noticing in her early analysis about not making a big deal about it, but being like supportive, but also not saying it defines exactly who you are or all of you. ADHD is part of who I am, always will be, always has been. And it's the fact that people just say, what do you need? So thank you. I feel so, you know, the response I had the other day, which was beautiful, was thank you. Yeah, thank you for telling me, what do you need? And just that simple act. And then it hasn't changed anything. You know, the fact that, you know, once someone knows, they're just thinking, okay, I might have to send presentations the night before just for that additional processing time, or something like that. And those are small things that Sarah spoke about mean a lot, because it means that they want you to stay in the team. They don't see you as being a drag on resources, or you know, they can get someone better. It just means that they just care about you as a human.
It's that acceptance that comes into it, from the sounds of it.
Yeah, I feel very accepted.
We accept you, man.
Thank you. I have a large collection. For your listeners who won't be able to see a video feed here, I have a large collection of Lego around my office, as well as its other items of interest. So I think there may have been some hints for people before my disclosure. There may have been, yes, some neurospiciness around.
Yeah. And this wasn't in the needs analysis, but this is also part of the journey that we've had. And it goes back to that visibility, right? So as community, I think it also is helpful for, you know, a lot of us are late diagnosed or late realized. I know all three of us are.
Most of the survey participants were as well.
Yeah. And it's, before starting this project, I was very burnt out after my PhD. I was considering not working in this area at all, even though I love it. But doing that initial interview series that we had, I had already just figured out I was an ADHDer, but it was through meeting other people and hearing their stories, as Sarah was saying earlier, oh, I'm also autistic. it was that visibility, that exposure and rewriting of what it would mean to be autistic.
Mm-hmm.
And having that lived experience and having those mentors that with lived experience, which also helped myself. So yeah, I'd say it's that enabler for success would be self-awareness and being able to know who you are, because a lot of us, you know, if we weren't diagnosed, or even if you are, you blame yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very empowering to know that there are others kind of living like you.
And did your needs analysis, were students involved in that as well, like staff and student component?
So my one was just staff, and Jess is about to launch the student one. So that's just being put into Qualtrics now.
So they're kind of like the next phase at a university-wide kind of level.
Mm-hmm. We're hoping to launch it next week. And again, it's open to anyone who identifies as neurodivergent as a student, so undergrad and postgrad here at the University of Melbourne, just to look at a whole lot of things like disclosure and experiences, academic, social, first year experiences, understanding at the university, and getting them also to co-design some of our future initiatives if they want to help us co-design.
Yeah. Do you feel like that opportunity or given that opportunity to co-design is something that's quite significant to this project with like the lived experience element?
Yeah. I haven't analysed those areas yet just because of how it all shook out so far. And because it's mainly open text boxes, but we've done a lot of, we did a lot of like, what resources are you already finding useful at the university? What should we be doing and should not be doing? What do people want to see in workshops around neurodiversity, and what are the risks and, you know, ways that we can mitigate those risks? And so we've had a huge amount of really good co-design, and then we've in terms of getting as many different people involved in that as possible, and then we've also just had our first advisory group meeting which Matt can
we have an advisory group because we need to make sure the three of us we spoke before we started, a few listeners before we started recording this podcast, we joked about our hive mind and about how we are mind meld, the three of us. And it's about making sure we have outside perspectives from people who aren't part of the project team. So we want to make sure that we're reaching as many parts of the university as possible. So we have an advisory group, which people who self-nominated to be on that advisory group and trying to reach all those corners. So we've got people in like regional health, for example, on campuses outside of metropolitan Melbourne. And just what does that mean in terms of support for those communities, for neurodivergent people working away from Melbourne? If you're listening from overseas, Melbourne's about 5 million people. But after that, it gets a lot smaller. I think Geelong's about 250,000 people. Then my hometown, Ballarat, is about 120,000 in Bendigo. But there's a lot of other smaller communities. And we know that for a lot of our university students, the price of living in Melbourne is very expensive. Or the fact that housing insecurity, that can't get housing, is, it can be a real challenge. So having, making sure that we are supporting regional and rural students who may be at other campuses is really key. And just thinking about how we actually find out what's happening out there, whether it's regional, rural, whether it's, you know, other faculties besides education. So having an advisory group is central to make sure we're hitting the mark. We might think something's working. We might have like blind spots. We talked about that nexus of identities. There may be something that's not working for our community members who are identified as First Nations peoples, as well as being neurodivergent. It's getting perspectives, other perspectives, looking at a body of work and providing a safe space for them to critically examine and interrogate and provide feedback on what we're doing. Because the main thing that matters is that what we're doing actually brings about the change people want and not the change we think they want.
Mm. And have you actually seen neuroaffirming practices being implemented across the university as a result?
One of the great things I think about this project is there already is great things happening out at the University of Melbourne. And I think, I don't know if Jess and Sarah agree, we've seen pockets We really have seen pockets of people doing really cool things that are experimental, that are neurodiversity affirming. They're not always, you know, they're not always large scale, or they're not, you know, but they're things that seem to be making a positive difference. So it's really putting the spotlight on those. I don't know, Jess and Sarah, what you think.
Yeah, I think so. And a lot of what we've been doing so far, we wanted to get the staff needs analysis sorted before doing a full formal workshop series, just to find out what people want to learn. Although having read through quite a lot of those responses, it looks like people are actually wanting a lot of what we've already been doing. We kept on getting like requests to do professional development and things like that. And so it's only been sort of hour and a half long workshops so far, but we've had really, really positive responses from those. And, you know, people sort of talking about how they're going to implement some of those learnings in their classrooms and things like that. So, look, it sometimes feels small, you know, you're getting groups of 20 people at a time maybe, but also it's like, well, if one of those classrooms is made more neurodiversity affirming, then that's going to really help, you know, the students in that class, and, you know, slowly permeate. And we're hoping to ramp up those workshops as well. So that'll be, yeah, it'll be really good.
Yeah. And another thing that has happened organically, we had planned on doing this later down the track, was we had a few research groups reach out to us who were wanting to do research in the space, but they wanted to make sure it was neurodiversity affirming and wanted some feedback, community feedback, and just to run things by us to make sure, yeah, it was just being done in a safe way. And I think that's also another positive thing we've seen happen as a result of this project just existing, is that there is a space that people can turn to if they are looking at doing this type of work, and they don't have to make a call out to the other and hope that someone comes help them.
It's worth noting that it's not always a fight, you know, like it does, you know, sometimes it feels like, oh, there's all these horrible things happening and we have to fight it, but actually a lot of the time there's a lot of people who want to be doing the right thing, they just have absolutely no idea how, which is understandable considering how much stereotypical information and bad information and conflicting their information there is in this space, you know. And a lot of people with really horrible opinions who will say them very loudly in front of other people. And so, yeah, it's like, it's not always,
I'll say the vast majority of people really, really want to do the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this, the quality of education around differences such as autism and ADHD has not been great. Historically, we're getting much better. Our understandings are evolving, and we're at a critical juncture where we are moving towards this neurodiversity affirming. But I think the vast majority of people really want to do the right thing. I guess in our positions, we hear the horror stories.
Yeah.
And yeah, and that's what you, and that's what you sometimes can dwell on. But then you just, you that's a discredit to the a lot of people who are doing the right thing, including the majority of the leadership of our institution, who fully back us, have given us the support for the 2 years. You know, where other institutions, people have tried to set things up and they've been told no. What was amazing about our trip to the US, visiting different institutions, was how many, like, we met the mirror inverses of ourselves. Like, there's the mirror, Sarah, Jess and Matt.
Yeah.
And having those similar experiences they're having. So it's not a University of Melbourne challenge. It's not an Australian university challenge. It's a global higher education challenge. And we need a global community that transcends, you know, borders, and that supports each other. And together we can find out how to do better, because a lot of people want to, just don't know how.
I like what you said about the small changes as well. Our last podcast episode was actually called Small Changes Are Powerful Changes, because we had a very similar conversation around how sometimes it is those small things that can make a difference. So it's really nice to hear that. I guess from other institutions and other spaces actually, you know, being recognised as well.
I think it's worth noting, I think that one thing that we're really good at as neurodivergent people is sometimes trusting each other. Like, I feel like when we talk to people from those other institutions, it was like, oh, you're neurodivergent too, we can collaborate, you know? Like, we may not always have a lot of trust of other people, but we often sort of are good at collaborating with each other, I think, because we do have a lot of that shared experience and shared understanding. And it's kind of like when you meet another neurodivergent person, you're like, yes, let's help each other, you know?
And I think part of our role as well is then to educate and help other people understand us more so that we do feel safe collaborating with a whole range of neurotypes and that we can have those experiences without the trauma that a lot of us bring to this from our experiences. It's a tough journey, but go on, Matt.
Oh, I was just gonna say, you talked about the positive examples of things that work really well and the small things. My story is different from, you know, Jess and Sarah, and their stories are for them to share, of course. My own story has been really positive, and it might be that male privilege. But I have had people just accept me at face value. And the vast majority of my neurotypical colleagues have just accepted, you know, said to me, it's just Matt, you know, it's just the way he is, you know. And I think I've been allowed to largely be myself. I talk a lot. I'm loud. Impulse control in meetings when something I'm really passionate about is something I'm really working on. But people have still, like, I felt like I've been, you know, this is my community, the faculty of education. I think it takes us a long time to go anywhere. The joke, particularly Sarah makes the joke, because I have to say hi to a lot of people. People say hi to me.
He has to say hi to every single person in the building before he can leave.
It's a joke. It's kind of not a joke. But it is. Like, I have felt very welcomed, and I think that starts from our dean down. When I first, our dean first came on board at the Faculty of Education, he asked to see the low impact sensory space we just built. And I knew he was really busy, but we just wanted a quick one-on-one tour of it. And then we ended up talking for about 40 minutes. And just, his experiences of education and, asking me questions about why their spaces are important. You could get the sense that he cared about, and that's nice. You don't get that all the time. So I feel very fortunate.
And that's the type of community, that's the type of goal. The type of project, not just us, but we want for everyone.
I do think, there's definitely something going on there. And it's nice to have Matt as our example of how things can go right. Because I do feel like all the things that Matt's like, I was just accepted for these things, I have definitely been punished for again and again and again. And as a neurodivergent woman, you know,
agreed.
You know, but it's like, yes, it is good having someone on the team who's had good experiences and can be positive about it.
And I don't want to embarrass them, but that started with my direct line manager, who is just, both of them. I had one for a long time, and she's just stepped down, which is sad, but I've got another wonderful one. And I've just, having, as I like to call them, the Wise Women of Learning Intervention, who are our senior leadership team, have just always protected me and made taking off the edge of academia. And I think that's kind of what we all aspire to be, is to be the next generation of supervisors. If people just go, you know what, I don't know what to do, I just need help, and they feel safe to come to us. So I see us as all hopefully being professors here at the University of Melbourne one day, and being able to lead and to make sure the next generation have a ladder so they can come here and know that they'll be supported and they'll be safe.
Do you have any advice for other university staff who are interested in similar initiatives?
Go straight to the top. Don't let it die by subcommittee. Am I allowed to say that? Do you want me to?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Find other people in your community who have the same heart for it because you can't do it alone. I think the success, as Matt said earlier, and we've all touched upon it, is that we do have each other, and if one of us falls or is having a really rough time, the others are there always. And it's been reciprocated for all of us. And you kind of need that if you're going to make any big institutional changes. And yeah, go straight to the top. Find the change makers, find your allies throughout the university.
We've been really lucky to find a lot of people sort of scattered across the university who will just sort of help us. And then we find out later they're like, me too. And that's really, really nice. And I think that that's one of those things where it's like when you become visible, it's terrifying to become visible and to be like, yeah, everybody knows that I, you know, this is my thing. But it's also you find so many allies because we are everywhere. You know, neurodivergent people are all over the place. We're in every role. We're in every, you know. And there are people... And like I said, we like to collaborate with each other. We trust each other.
We find each other.
We find each other. So building those networks sort of can help everyone. And also you'll find allies everywhere and amazing people everywhere. So yeah, that's really lovely.
I want to call our neurodiversity affirming training or awareness raising training. Watch out, there's a neurodivergent behind you. Because there will be everywhere. And that, you know, that visibility piece about people, you know, we do know, that statistically it's somewhere between 15-20%, depending on, you know, what you include in the umbrella of neurodivergence.
And that's the general population.
That's the general population. Yeah. You can spend your lifetime looking at how you can use video games to help, you know, neurodivergent children to develop friendships and build collaborative skills. It's like, that's my area. And you're like, you know, this will shock you, but the game studies space is full of neurodivergent people.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that hopefully eventually we want to set up and when we have capacity is where we want to help start a global network of people who want other universities who want to do similar initiatives and somehow find a way that we can all talk together and share our successes and our challenges and to really build each other up in this effort. So I think that's the other thing. We all need to just band together.
And where could our listeners go to find out more about the University of Melbourne's Neurodiversity Project?
You can go to our website, which I have here, which is unimelb.edu.au/neurodiversity. That's where a lot of our information is. We will be updating it as we go along.
We also, like, if you follow the University of Melbourne social media channels, we do send a feature every now and again on our University of Melbourne social media channels.
I didn't know this because I don't follow them.
Matt is also good at LinkedIn. Sarah and I are not, but I know I will get on soon.
Sarah's got a LinkedIn account now.
Yeah, I've got a LinkedIn account.
LinkedIn, but I hadn't been updated in like 2 years.
So that's right.
Slowly updating that. It's just in more emails to look at.
I had made a LinkedIn years and years ago. I never posted anything. And then ignored it until people kept on telling me that they'd enjoyed watching our travels on Matt's LinkedIn. And I was like, oh, I've got to see what Matt's been watching.
Well, we do share the podcast on LinkedIn. So now that I know someone on LinkedIn, I can actually tag you in it as well.
Yeah. There you go. Awesome. More peer pressure to get LinkedIn.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Matt, Sarah, and Jess. It has been such a pleasure to have you and to just hear about all the incredible work that you do. And thank you, as always, to our listeners. You can keep up to date with our podcast and other events of the Association of Neurodivergent and Disabled Glamour Professionals Australia on our website at ampa.org. Thank you, and until next time.